Welcome back, everyone, to the Why Marketing Podcast. My name is Rusty Pepper, and over there is Peter Horst. How you doing, Peter?
I am great, Rusty. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm excited about this conversation because it involves a lot of the things I love. I love sports, specifically football. I love coaching. As a parent, I've coached all four of my kids. I love marketing. I love partnerships, and I love brand building. So we're going to combine all that into this one awesome episode that I can't wait for us to dive into.
I'm looking forward to it. We have a really good one on the line here.
Yeah. So why don't I go ahead and get them introduced? We've got on the show today, Rod Davis, the managing director of USA Football. So Rod, welcome to the Why Marketing Podcast.
Thanks, Rusty. Good to be with you and Peter today.
I've been excited to be able to have this conversation with you because I know there's going to be a lot we're going to be able to uncover and discuss. But before we dive into your background and USA Football, I want to do a quick speed round with you and Peter where we can just get to know you a little bit better on a personal level. So if you're ready, I'm going to go ahead and roll out the very first question. Are you a night owl or are you an early bird?
I'm an early bird. I like the quiet and the peacefulness of the morning hours. I'm usually the first one up at the house and allows me to sort of, you know, find the on-ramp for the day, get situated. But I enjoy that peace and quiet first thing and a little alone time, I guess.
Well, I can't say I enjoy being an early bird, but at this point in my life, I seem to be stuck being an early bird, even though I conceptually much prefer being a night owl.
I try staying up late at night. I just can't do it. I've got a curse from my father. I'm up at like 4:30 every single day. And it's just, but I enjoy it. I like being up before everybody else. I like the way you phrase that though, Rod, the on-ramp for the day. That was a good way of saying it. Next question. When you were a kid, what was your favorite game that you played in gym class?
You know, for me, I was trying to kind of thinking real quickly back all those years, like what did we play? And the one that jumps out that I really liked was kickball. And I don't know if it, I'm not sure why. I enjoyed playing all sports growing up, but baseball was certainly popular. And maybe because it kind of had some resemblance to that game, I enjoyed that. But kickball is the one that stands out for me.
It's a good answer.
For me, it was dodgeball. You know, sometimes we'd have to suffer through the calisthenics or the gymnastics equipment, but dodgeball was always the treat when he felt we deserved a little reward for something.
When you said gymnastics, the one that jumped out to me was what I didn't want to do, and that was gymnastics. And I remember this was more in high school, but they had the pommel horse and you had to, you know, sort of vault over it. And I remember that being the absolute worst visual for me at that point. I was like, there was no way I wanted to try to clear that thing.
Yeah, I have grim memories of that one too.
I don't remember the pommel horse, but I remember the rope they tied.
Oh yeah,
tethered to the ceiling. Yeah, I made the mistake once of like sliding down too fast.
It was
rough everywhere. It wasn't just the hands; it was rough pretty much everywhere. You learn
that's
a lesson though.
Only make once though.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Next question: what's one item on your bucket list?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure why, but I keep connecting to a sporting event in the Kentucky Derby. And it's kind of shame on me as somebody who works in sports. I've been fortunate to go to a lot of events and it's one I haven't been to. So I guess Kentucky Derby's my answer.
I've had my eye on a trip where you snorkel somewhere north of Norway, I think, with orcas. So I like to do, I've done a lot of scuba diving all over the world, but this would be a particularly unique experience. So if my wife will give the go ahead on that one, that's down the road.
I like that. That's one I might have to add to my list as well.
Well, we'll go together.
I like that. And this last one, Rod, is just for you. What brand inspires you most?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, there are lots of brands that I think have done some great things. But inspire me. I really want to have such a clever answer. And I feel like I'm going to let you both down because the one that jumps out at me is going to seem to be an obvious answer for a sports guy, and that's Nike. And I think it's, you know, part of that is certainly what I view as one of the foundations, you know, in partnerships or sponsorships or sports marketing, but it's creating this emotional connection. And I think why they resonate with me is because they do it on multiple fronts. You know, they find ways to get their message out. Obviously, you know, so much of it is through, you know, broadcast television, advertising, commercials that we may see. But even if you watch things like the, you know, the men's basketball tournament that's been happening, and, you know, you see what they do with sideline apparel, or you'll see other sort of, you know, social posts and, you know, stories that they run on an Instagram, for example. And so I think they're very creative in using their brand to be authentic back to the marketplace. And I think a lot of that is really being masters of connecting emotionally with athletes. And no matter how you define that for yourself, if you're, you know, the elite level athlete or the weekend warrior or, you know, mom or dad who's got kids in the sport. So again, I wish I would have had a really clever answer for you guys, but I'm going to go with the swoosh out of Oregon on this one.
I feel for you because, you know, in my career, I've made a million ads, but then whenever someone would ask me at a dinner or a cocktail party, so what's your favorite ad running? I'd always, for some reason, you know, be left dumbstruck. It's like, gosh, I don't know. I should have an answer at the tip of my tongue. But having said all that, I totally, totally agree with you about Nike. In addition to everything you've said and all the interesting innovations, they're also just a really brave marketer. And they will stake out positions that they know will be unpopular, but that are very long-term forward-looking about, we know who our audience is. We know who our audience will be in the next 10 years, and let's really resonate with them and know that some people may not love us. And that's the kind of brave marketing that ultimately, you know, sets up generations of a powerful franchise versus trying to kind of blow the wind too much.
Yeah, I think, you know, something I'll latch onto for just a second is, you know, you use the, you know, the adjective brave, and yeah, they are that. And, you know, one example, you know, thinking about the sport of football, and certainly this was, you know, not a topic that impacted us, you know, so much at the youth level, but, you know, was Colin Kaepernick. And, you know, that was a lightning rod for our country. And, you know, there've been a lot of other, you know, messages around that, and people have their own personal stances and whatnot. But, you know, he's, you know, was, you know, has a deal with Nike, and Nike stood by him and in fact launched a shoe, you know, a signature shoe for him with his image on it, and donated proceeds. And so to your point about being brave, whether they were going to, you know, lose customers or perhaps find more, they took a stance, and they took a stance about the power of sports and the people they believe in. And so whether you agree with them or disagree with them, I think they really did exactly that, which was they were brave in how they went to market and you know, brave in communicating what matters to them.
Yeah, and it was by no means an easy, obvious answer. I had an awful lot of very smart marketer friends say to me, that's the dumbest thing they could ever do. They've killed their franchise. And it was sort of brand suicide. And then sure enough, next earnings report, they're showing, you know, accelerating sales. And, you know, sure, there were a bunch of middle-aged guys burning their golf socks. But, you know, that Nike was very clear, not only what they stand for as a brand, but also where their business will be coming from, you know, diverse, younger audiences in the big global mega cities. And this is the kind of position that resonates with them. So it was very savvy and yet very bold and very true to their DNA, which is really cool to see.
Let's now jump into the main part of our podcast. And Rod, I want us to talk about a little bit about your background in USA Football and how are you guys putting yourselves out there with your consumers?
So the organization is considered the national governing body for youth football, much like other national governing bodies in the Olympic movement, whether you think of, you know, hockey or swimming. USA Football has sort of a similar mandate, and NGBs really operate with some consistent principles. One is, and certainly this is the case of USA Football, is to serve as the core education provider. And so again, if you think about this organization being the steward of youth football, one of the areas that the company can serve the sport is by helping commissioners and coaches and ultimately parents and players have the, you know, have the best possible experience. And so the organization works with leagues to, again, this is also a volunteer driven model, right? So as parents, you know, we may have each found ourselves in the position where, you know, we're at that parent meeting and we need coaches and, you know, we raise our hand, or in some cases, you know, the phrase is that we are voluntold that we had to do it. And so, you know, you've got moms and dads all over the country that, you know, are stepping up and coaching youth sports, in this case, youth football. Some of those folks don't have any experience whatsoever. You also have at the league level, the club level, you've got a volunteer board who is dealing with everything from securing fields and finding referees to fundraising to promoting registration and growing participation to running a board of directors and engaging parents. And so our role is trying to provide those organizations with resources, insights, data points, tools, et cetera, to help them run leagues, to help them coach teams, et cetera. The second part of the organization is really serving as the chief marketing arm for the sport. So we look for opportunities to promote participation, to grow participation. Again, you know, sort of legislatively serve as that advocate on behalf of the sport, kind of the brand steward. And if there are things that come up in the industry, then we, you know, we'll take the role of being that leading voice. Because of our relationship with the NFL and the foundation, we worked with the 32 clubs on activation and third-party promotions. We work in the collegiate space with the college football playoff and conferences and individual universities. And so we find opportunities for that third-party amplification, whether it's a player or an influencer or a university or a club, to promote the game and promote participation, to highlight game types at a more micro level. How do we grow flag football that is gaining in popularity? How do we continue to grow? How do we define a female participation pathway as more girls want to play the sport? How do we pursue and investigate opportunities like the inclusion of flag football in the 2028 Olympics? How do we partner with the NFL in doing that and working with the LA Organizing Committee and through the International Federation? How do we define a national team or a high-performance pathway as there are international competitions? So there are a lot of things that go into the organization, but chief among them is really education and player safety and advances in the game and coaching instruction and curriculum and how we can offer those kinds of tools for leagues to run efficiently and for coaches to be able to properly instruct the sport, make sure it's a safe and positive playing experience. And then again, just to promote the sport and keep it in the positive headlines and find promotional platforms that give us a chance to promote the sport. My role particularly is managing what we define as the sales and marketing functions. Essentially, you could think of it as having the commercial side of the operation. So the team that I work most closely with and direct is our events team and all the events that we actually conduct either at the grassroots level or related to the high performance pathway. I also oversee what we call our product marketing and consulting team. So all the football related products and services that we have, whether it's coach certification or coaching tools, our league enrollment, all those elements that we extend to leagues and coaches across the country, our brand marketing. So again, think of those third party promotions and our own social media, brand positioning and marketing, our grants department. We award a significant amount of money back to youth organizations in the sport. This year, we're looking to distribute $2 million back to organizations to help them with the cost that they have for running leagues. We just launched our cycle this year for league enrollment. We'll have in excess of some 6,000 clubs and leagues around the country that will enroll with us. That is simply a free registration, starts to get them access into other tools and resources. We also just launched our coach certification program. We'll certify some 100,000 plus coaches this year. They'll go through the process to get educated. We also will administer a league excellence program where we actually recognize leagues and reward them for earning different status with you know, kind of following the best practices of league operation. We have a what we call the football development model. Probably the easiest way to think about that is use an analogy from baseball. If you're playing youth baseball, you think about the progression of T-ball to coach pitch to player pitch. You think about when you start out as a younger player, you know, the base paths are shorter and the pitching mound is closer and the fences are closer. And as you get older, some of those dimensions expand. We have a very similar model in football. We think about game types being non-contact, like a flag or a 7v7. We think about limited contact, where you would literally wear football pads and shoulder pads and a helmet. But game types like padded flag or even tackle bar, which teach you the fundamentals of the game and you're learning to play with equipment, but the game type does not allow you to take the player to the ground. So padded flag is probably obvious. Tackle bar is actually a harness that players wear. It has sort of a Velcro cylinder on the back. And what it does is it teaches an athlete to break down, kind of wrap the opposing ball carrier, and you pull the cylinder off the harness. So again, you're not tackling to the ground. But those game types also, you know, shorter field is typically a younger set. Typically, you don't have as many players on the field. So it could be 66 or 77, depending upon your numbers. You know, 2-point stands, no special teams, no blitzing. So again, think of it as a bridge game. Think of it as a transition before a tackle football. So those are some of the things that we're doing. We also have a 10-city promotional tour that we're doing called the Summer Blitz. It's designed to bring coaches and commissioners and players together. And again, sort of almost sort of a jamboree type where we can do clinics and talks and share resources and tools and allow them to network and at the same time have clinics on the field and engage in kind of on-field instruction and generate local attention for the marketplace. So those are some of the big tentpole events for us this year.
Wow. Well, you've certainly got your hands full. You know, in some ways, it seems like you have the world's greatest job, right? Who doesn't love football? And you're right there in the middle of it. And yet, you know, surely there are, like for all of us, you have some challenges that you're dealing with. What are the big, you know, things to solve for, challenges you're wrestling with as you steward, you know, America's favorite sport?
Sure. You know, I think one of them is a challenge that lots of organizations, you know, whether you're in sports or not, are solving for. And that is sort of, you know, coming out of COVID, how do we pick back up and get back to what may be a new normal? What do they have to do different now as a result of this? And, you know, youth sports in general and youth football specifically are not exempt from that. So what are the new protocols? What are the new procedures that we have to think about, you know, in the sport? You know, do leagues need to do temperature checks, you know, before games? You know, does this require additional supplies, you know, in terms of cleaning and sanitation? What about instructions for parents in terms of, you know, equipment after practices because of the contact and you know, making contact with other players? We had a high school combine last weekend, and we had 750 players, and, you know, that came into the Cowboys practice facility in Frisco. And how we registered those athletes and how we engaged with those athletes was completely different than a year ago. You know, we had a different registration process, you know, because of COVID. We had, you know, mask mandates, and, you know, even staff travel was different and protocols related to travel. So, you know, that's one issue that we will continue to monitor as on a state-by-state basis. And it's an area that we have sort of tried to help counsel and provide, you know, input and resources and help stimulate a conversation and bring leagues together to share ideas and find case studies. So that is certainly one. And then I think by extension of that, going back to the comment I shared about grants, we're trying to, you know, stimulate the, you know, the youth football economy, if you will. And so this is more money than we've ever given away. And so, you know, that requires us to have an administrative process and a fulfillment process and, you know, new partners to come on board to help us. And so, again, we take this sort of positive power of youth sports. I think we all embrace what sports can do for us in general, how it brings community together. In some cases at the youth level, it probably really brings communities together. There's a rallying point, you know, whether it's your high school team and success they're having, or it's Saturday mornings at the youth field and seeing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of kids out there with their parents and grandparents and siblings and you know, having an experience of being on a team. And so it's how do we help facilitate that? How do we help leagues that, you know, our country is different? You know, the job market's been suppressed and disposable income is different, and, you know, things may cost more now. So how do we help leagues come back? How do we help them and provide them with resources to help with costs? Like, like uniforms and equipment and whatnot. We also found that through a new partnership, we have basically a COVID protection, what we call season protector, and it's insurance to help our leagues protect themselves against flare-ups in school systems where I've started my league, I've had my 500 kids pay their $200, and what happens in 6 weeks, I've got the money, I've now paid for uniforms and equipment, and I'm starting to pay my other expenses, and there's an outbreak in our town, and school is shut down, and I don't have my league, and I've got 200 parents that want their money back, and I don't have it because I've had to invest it in the league operations. Well, we found a solution to that market, or a solution to that challenge. So our role is to try to find answers to problems. Our job is to try to fill voids for them, to knock down the barriers, to help them with their operations. And so I think a lot of it is coming out of, you know, the pandemic of last year and how we rebound from that.
So Rod, I know that sponsorships are kind of a part of your world at USA Football, but pulling way back, you've got a long, deep history in the world of sports and sponsorships. And it's such an interesting one because it's so high profile. It can be such a high ticket item. And it's the subject of a lot of hand-wringing and big decision-making on the parts of brands because it often involves writing a big check. And sometimes it's hard to know if it's working. And there are academics who do nothing but study the effectiveness and economics of sponsorships. From your perspective, having been on the side of, you know, representing the sport, how does a brand think about really making a successful sponsorship relationship? How do they turn that into great value for the brand, for their business? What can you share with us from the perspective you've had over the years?
Yeah, I'll start with kind of the funny little quip in advertising and marketing, and you may have heard this, but you know, the CMO says, I know that half of my marketing is working. The problem is I just don't know which half. And it's kind of along the same line with sponsorship where, you know, it's become a more integral and I think meaningful part of the broad marketing mix. And you know, we all know this where each brand or each marketer has its own unique set of challenges and how they operate and where they sell and their distribution, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, you have some organizations, you know, you think about, you know, the real big, you know, global brands, the P&Gs, the, you know, the Toyotas, the Visas, and, you know, how they have a whole, you know, plethora of sort of tactics from, you know, advertising and social and endorsements and PR and sports marketing and, you know, retail and channel, you know, channel marketing, et cetera. And then you've got some that, wow, I'm word of mouth. I try to go to events only. And so one thing is I have worked with companies that are very large and very significant brands. And I've worked with companies that take a much smaller approach and that whose resources are completely different. But I think that the underlying foundation in each of those is understanding the purpose of why you're doing it. And I think because in many cases, I work with challenger brands. I have been in the Olympic movement, spent a lot of years there, and I sold for very high profile national governing bodies. But I wasn't selling the U.S., you know, the U.S. Olympic team, or I wasn't selling the Olympic Games. And so what I was selling was a different platform. You know, it was perhaps working with, you know, with U.S. swimming or USA Swimming and finding the role that we could play in your Olympic investment or finding the role we could play in your youth sports marketing plan. And so, you know, like anything, sponsorship, in my view, is we've got to solve problems for the companies that we're working with. You know, there's a marketing void, there's a promotional void, there's a sales void, there's a brand void, there's a communications void. What are we going to bring to the table to help that brand and engage with the stakeholders that we need? So the first point is always really trying to understand what we offer. You know, if I'm on the property side, it's what we offer, what we can deliver, how do we help stand, you know, help a brand stand out? What's the point of difference? What are the attributes and kind of that mutual IP that we can exchange and sort of prop each other? And then what becomes the, you know, the tactical strategic direction? A lot of brands, you know, still as fundamentally basic as it sounds, the number one reason brands get involved with sponsorship is for brand awareness. And so you get into basic things like, you know, signage and being included on websites And honestly, that's pretty elementary stuff. And yet it's one of the biggest drivers, you know, for sponsorship. You also hear, you know, the slang term, if you will, is chairman's choice. And I think, you know, golf gets a rap for that. You know, like, why are these brands spending the kind of money they're spending on the weekend for a professional golf tournament? Well, if the C-suite likes it or the chairman likes it, and then the CMO is trying to figure out, okay, you know, we just spent X, you know, millions of dollars for this particular platform this weekend, and it's in, you know, this market. How does that affect my customers in a market on the opposite side of the United States? How does it affect the co-op in, you know, in Northwest, you know, the Northwest part of the United States that's paying into my marketing fund while I sponsor a tournament in Florida? How do I balance all that out? So there are a lot of dynamics, a lot of moving pieces, but fundamentally it's about aligning with properties, and it's about aligning brands and properties that share similar values, that are aligned on common values, on common objectives. It's trying to find how I, as the brand, can have a unique point of voice, how I can stand out. It's protecting my brand against, you know, the properties. You know, you think about the morals clauses and things like that, particularly with, you know, with individual athletes, that they're, you know, they're not going to harm my reputation because I'm investing with them, or they're wearing my logo on their shirt or their helmet, you know, hat or their jersey or their race car, whatever the case may be. So I think the core fundamental is aligning brands and properties that have similar values and share a similar point of view.
Those are some interesting points. So Peter, I want to now get your perspective, since you spent so much time throughout your career as a CMO at Hershey's, Ameritrade, Capital One. Obviously, sponsorships were pretty big deals at those organizations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And
so based on what Rob was talking about, put your CMO cap back on. When you're looking at it from a brand perspective, what are some of the measurements and metrics that you were using to evaluate, does this sponsorship make sense for our brand to be involved with?
Well, you know, I was going to say that I completely agree with Rod's point about be very clear on what job you're trying to get done. And that's such a lesson for all channels. You know, so often I'll hear someone say, hey, we have to have a Snapchat strategy. Well, why? Because it's new, because it's cool, because you think everybody does, you know, but what job is that going to do for you? Be really clear about that. Likewise with sponsorships generally, and with, you know, which sponsorship to do, to what end. So totally agree with that one. My build to that was going to be that, you know, I always used to think of sponsorships like, you know, going on a cruise where you write a check to go on the cruise, which you should pretty much plan on writing an equal check for the cocktails and the extra, you know, little excursions and the t-shirts and, you know, the having your daughter's hair braided. And if you don't plan to spend that money, then you'll probably not really get as much out of the first money you spent.
And you talk about the activations part of that?
Exactly. So when it comes to, exactly. So when it comes to a sponsorship, yes, you write the check so that you can be the official sponsor of X. But then the work starts on how am I going to activate it? How am I going to really work closely with, you know, the property to say, how can we bring this thing to life? What can we do? What else can we kind of create together around it so that it really sings? And that really, to me, is where I see so much money being wasted, where, you know, someone's name comes up at the billboard. And other than that, you kind of forget, versus those that really organically develop a very rich 360 surround sound experience with the property sponsorship as the tentpole. So, and to your question in terms of metrics, it really goes back to Rod's point around, you know, what were some of the things we were looking to get? And, you know, depending on the situation, it may have been, you know, how much play was there in the media? So PR related metrics, it might have been how many total people did we touch through the various experiences we created? So if there was some kind of fanfare experience, how many people came through? You know, if there may have been sampling involved. So it really varied from, you know, sometimes acquisition, sometimes brand metrics, but the scorecard really needed to be very bespoke crafted for the brand and the objectives around that particular property.
If I might add on to that, I mean, there really are so many different motivating factors, right? I mean, think about, you know, Coke and Pepsi are easy examples here where you think about the seasonality, you know, right? So, you know, Pepsi's got the NFL. So that means, you know, Coke's looking to secure the NBA, you know, Coke has, you know, golf, and, you know, Pepsi may have the, you know, the action sports in the summer, or may have, you know, hockey, whatever the case is. So they, you've got sort of this, hey, I need a big fall tentpole promotion. I need a, you know, I need a holiday tentpole promotion. You know, those are the targets that are going after movies and big sporting events and the Olympics, the Super Bowl, the Grammys, you know, whatever it is. They need these big events because those deliver eyeballs. And so I've got to have an advertising play and visibility. And then to Peter's point, you know, it's everything else where, you know, when I was the chief revenue officer at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and as well as IndyCar, one of the elements that I had there at the Speedway was purchasing power. We're the world's largest single day sporting event. I mean, we had 300,000 people on site for the race, you know, actually in excess of that in 2016, which was the 100th anniversary of the 500. And when you start thinking about the buying power that we as a facility have, so now, you know, again, whether you're the Staples Center or you're Yankee Stadium, I mean, all these venues have that aspect, right? So now all of a sudden, if I'm the buyer, I'm thinking about, okay, what's the seasonality? What's the reach? To Peter's point, how much of their product are they going to buy? How much of my product can I sell outside of that venue? Because if I've got the Yankees, the power of that logo at retail, how many more cases or how many more bottles or how many more, you know, whatever your metric is, how many more of those will I sell through my channels because of the relationship? How can I use the benefits of the tickets and, you know, unique experiences, you know, like, hey, we're going to have, you know, we're going to set up a really cool dinner at home plate at Yankee Stadium for our 20 most important customers. And my competition doesn't get to do that. So how do I make that valuable for me? How do I take advantage of, hey, one of my benefits is I get to go on the, you know, I get to make a road trip with the Yankees. And so how do I use that? Or, you know, I'm going to go, you know, sign up with the new, you know, a new franchise in, you know, Las Vegas. You know, they didn't have professional sports. So team, you know, brands were signing up with, you know, the Las Vegas Knights in hockey because that gave me a different market. It took me into a different geography. And so there are just so many different ways to use sponsorship. They can address different business needs and different business challenges that a CMO has or a VP of sales. And so, you know, what's really key, and Peter said this, is it's making sure that you know what you're trying to achieve and making sure that the property can help you achieve that. And sometimes, you know, the reason that people buy, you know, Coke could sponsor us at the Speedway for one reason and Miller Beer sponsored us for a completely different reason. And Firestone came on board for yet a different reason. And so all of those are okay. Your partners can have different reasons for being involved with you. Just recognize that not all sponsorship is created the same and they're not all valued the same, but it doesn't mean you don't have to roll up your sleeves and absolutely under promise and over deliver for all those partners, but they all come to you for different reasons.
Which brands do you think have done it the best? There's some in our mind that we know it made no sense for them to do a sponsorship, but there are some out there that have just crushed it. Peter, Rob, which ones do you think you've done best?
That's a really good question. I mean, and I will preface this answer, the fact that I did some work with them on, you know, representing swimming and but Visa is one that comes to mind. I mean, you know, they did not have the Olympic sponsorship. Amex did and let it go. And they, you know, they saw it as a competitive opportunity. This was back in the day where, again, think about what Visa is. You know, Visa is a co-op. You know, like Visa is all about promoting you using this credit card and the financial power and the freedom and the flexibility. And Peter, if you have this Visa card, you get to go snorkel with the orcas because this card gives you the ability to go do what you want to do. And so that was part of a campaign they had, and they made their partners feel very special. And so for them, being part of the Olympic journey was great. They were an exclusive. You could only use your Visa to buy Olympic tickets. You could only use your Visa at the Olympic Games for merchandise and concessions. And so there's a business, a transaction benefit there. So it was business development, you know, sales. It was brand distinction. And they played off that, you know, Visa, it's everywhere you want to be. If you want to go somewhere, we're the card that's going to take you there. But at the end of the day, I don't write my monthly check to pay my Visa bill to Visa, right? I send it to Chase or, you know, PNC or Capital One or whomever. So they're a co-op. They're promoting you to sort of spend. And they, I thought they were very effective in that. You know, they brought athletes on board. I happened to be involved in the initial relationship with Michael Phelps. It was Michael's first endorsement, I think, outside the endemics. And we identified him on a, you know, I was asked, you know, on from Visa, like, hey, we're looking for this type of an athlete. I checked with the folks inside our shop who really knew the sport. This was the kid. We were coming out of the 2000 Olympics. And I think Michael was one of five athletes on the 2000 Olympic team that did not win a medal. And so they got in on the early stages. Michael obviously took off and became, you know, the greatest Olympian of all time. And Visa used him in that way to again, distinguish themselves from their competitor. Again, I think that was one aspect of a multiple sort of pronged approach in what they were doing in terms of, you know, the whole Visa, it's everywhere you want to be campaign.
Well, Rusty, I think it's fair to say that Rod's career path is one that many would have given their eye teeth to enjoy. You've been all kinds of exciting places in the middle of all kinds of amazing, iconic venues, brands, and experiences, really at the epicenter of how to make them special for fans, special for viewers, special for sponsors. So fascinating conversation, and we appreciate your insights. Rusty, any closing thoughts?
Actually, I would love to get your answer to that question.
Oh, my answer? Well, I guess I would not for a moment say the best example, but I think it highlights the principle I was talking about before, and that's Capital One. And years ago, as you know, we were looking for, you know, ways to continue building the brand, you know, there was one choice, which was called write a big fat check for a giant, you know, sponsorship with all kinds of clear limitations on how and where you could show up. And I will take no personal credit for this. This was, you know, brilliant folks in the sponsorship team. We ended up sponsoring a fairly not top tier bowl game, called it the Capital One Bowl, so we could actually name it. From that, built with a media partner, ESPN, a thing called Bowl Week, which didn't exist, but it was a pure media invention that let us own that and own all the sort of surround sound sponsorship of that thing. Then created the Capital One Mascot Challenge, that had the mascots from all the competing schools sort of go through various antics to earn votes from the public on who is the mascot of the year. And just again, layering, building. So there was a core thing called the sponsorship, which was by no means super expensive, but the juice came from how do you build upon that and get the most out of that day? How do you create an event around it? How do you create all these media properties around it? So the totality of the thing was far, far greater than the sum of its parts. So that exemplifies the principle that I was sort of trying to articulate earlier.
It's still around and it's still paying dividends. That's a great example of when you execute and you look at all the different ways that you can activate and engage with your customers and get your content and your message out there. Yep. Great example. Yep.
I think I just add one thing to Peter's comment, and I think that's a brilliant example and well executed and tremendous shelf life. It's, you know, it still resonates, it still works. But they found a space to own it, make it their own, right? I mean, you don't see other cards in that space, and they have really become synonymous. They have found a way to create equity for their company that make themselves stand out. It's a significant promotional window. It resonates. You can get into the business of having your theme cards and work with universities at the grassroots level. There's lots of ways to drill down on that. And I think that's an outstanding example.
Well, Rod, thank you so much for your time today and your insights. You're in the middle of some very exciting stuff, and we appreciate your sharing your experiences with us.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun to talk shop with you guys, and I appreciate you including me in your program. So thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning into the Why Marketing Podcast. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. And give us a 5-star rating while you're at it. Until the next time.